This podcast is from Allegro Non Troppo on Joy Melbourne 94.9 radio station, Melbourne, Australia, and is produced for you by Adam, Peter and Robert. This is Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network, presented by Adam Stobbs
and Peter Forty.
Allegro's been on air for quite a long time. We've been on the Community Radio for 1 year now, and I'd like to say a special hello and thank you to everybody listening in regional and rural Australia, particularly in small communities in Western Australia and the Northern Territory. Hello, Alice Springs, Yass, and several other places in Western New South Wales, Northern Victoria, and Western Queensland. So I got to meet quite a lot of people who run radio stations that play Allegro at the Community Radio Conference recently in Alice Springs, and they were telling me how many of the stations actually pick up Allegro, and it's a lot more than I thought. A lot of stations play it live on Thursday mornings on the Community Radio Network, and several of them take it on the Digital Delivery Network on DDN and play it at other times. So welcome to all of those people joining us across Australia.
And one of the most interesting little stories you were telling me about, I think, was where they actually broadcast it into the street?
Oh, that's Catherine. Catherine in the Northern Territory, because a lot of the local population, the Indigenous people, don't have radios, and they tend to sleep out in the street and live in the main couple of streets, so they have speakers up and down the main two streets, and they play the radio 24/7.
They must...
On 8KTR.
I'd love to see their reactions to some of the things that go to air.
Indeed. Joining us, what we're going to do on Allegro today is we're going to have a discussion with Robert Peterson. Now, we've had Nadia on twice. Nadia is blind, and she was born blind. And we've had two very interesting and in-depth conversations with Nadia. But Robert is slightly different. Robert was actually... had sight and he lost his sight, and we're going to explore some of the issues and some of the things that have affected Robert over the years, and to hear his story and engage in a little bit of conversation. People who go through significant loss must experience something that you and I, Peter, could probably only guess what it's like. People who lose one or two limbs, or lose sight, lose hearing, or lose one of their major faculties or mobility, it must be an enormous thing. Now, I had a mild illness some years ago, and I temporarily lost my sense of smell and taste. And it devastated me, and thank goodness it came back, because even though you'd think it's only minor, actually losing your sense of taste and smell...
Well, it affects your enjoyment of food.
Yes, and lots of other things. And I was so glad when it came back, and it didn't come back gradually. It came back all of a sudden, like the switch was on, and there it was.
You were very lucky.
So, yes, I was very lucky. I had a very mild stroke some years ago, and I had a partial paralysis, but that went away within a few hours, and I was very, very lucky then. And I just would like to say to the community, I understand partially through my own limited experience what it must be like to lose something significant. However, for people who lose something significant and it becomes a major part of their life from that point on, I can't imagine what it must be like to cope. And we're going to discuss this with Robert. Robert, hello and welcome to Allegro Non Troppo.
Good afternoon, thank you.
And thank you for coming along. Robert, tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you? How old are you? Get approximate.
Well, I can be very approximate, actually. I'm 50.
Okay.
I was born in Hobart, Tasmania. Spent my early part of my life there. When I was about 22, 23, I moved to Sydney.
That's a big change from Tasmania to Sydney.
Yes, it was a bit. I enjoyed Hobart. In fact, I went back there later in life for another few years. But, yes, it's a very nice, very tourist-orientated place. But I was feeling in the need of a change, and I was offered work in Sydney, so basically moved to Sydney.
What sort of work were you doing at this time?
Actually, I was working with the government. I was working in the forest industry at the time in Hobart, and was offered a job in the Tasmanian Government Tourist Bureau in Sydney at the time. And it was a good way of sort of moving to somewhere else. They paid for the move, and it was very interesting work, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Yeah, so this was when I was about 23. I still had sight then, of course. I spent probably the next 8 or so, 9 years in Sydney. During that period, I finished a university degree, which I started when I was in Hobart. I also got interested in learning to fly and spent a lot of time and effort learning to fly. The aim there was basically to become an airline pilot at the time. Probably in about 1987, I met a young lady, actually in Melbourne. I was living in Sydney, she was living in Canberra, and we were both from Hobart at the time. And we became good friends and eventually got engaged and got married. And on my honeymoon, we went to Southeast Asia, and I contracted a nasty little stomach virus, which laid me low for several days in Bangkok. And about 2 months afterwards, when I came home, I started feeling very lethargic, was requiring a lot of fluid, basically feeling not very well. And I went along to the doctor, and they did a series of tests, and found out basically that I had diabetes. What had happened, the virus had basically attacked, well, it forced my immune system to attack my own pancreas cells. And within a couple of months, the pancreatic cells which produce the insulin were basically destroyed, so it wasn't producing any insulin at all.
Was this as a result of the stomach virus?
The virus I contracted, yes.
In Bangkok?
Yes.
And then the immune system, when it was fighting that, then attacked your own pancreas?
Yes, that's right.
Oh, my goodness.
So basically I was left diabetic, and as I said, it was in a period of about 2 months to happen.
Can I just ask you about the stomach virus? Was it from food?
I believe it was actually from the milk for breakfast. We did actually talk about this, ex-wife, and we worked out that it had to be the milk, because that was the only different thing we'd actually had.
Oh, my goodness.
I'd had, so, yes.
You've just scared the pants off me now about going back to Bangkok.
Other than that, yes, it was a very nice trip. But, yes, it makes you sort of a little bit wary, I'm afraid.
Okay, so you got diagnosed with diabetes.
Diabetes, put onto insulin virtually straight away, and had regular checkups to specialists, eye specialists, foot specialists, diabetes specialists, etc., all the usual.
What were the symptoms?
Prior to being diagnosed, was basically a lot of required a lot of fluid. Very thirsty.
Mm-hmm.
Felt very tired, lethargic.
Mm-hmm.
Just very sort of felt very ill. Couldn't really put it down to one sort of illness, but just felt unwell.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife at the time said, "Oh yes, come along. We'll take you to the doctor." And sure enough, I ended up having a diagnosis of diabetes.
At that particular point, when you got diagnosed with diabetes, was it any sort of like huge drama, or were you sort of okay with it? How did it impact on you?
It didn't really dawn on me too much until actually a little bit afterwards, probably a month or so afterwards. I did a little bit of research on it and found out, oh yes, you can have all these nasty complications, one of them being obviously blindness.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, it sort of hit me a little bit, and I thought, well, I better take a little bit of care here. And for the most part, I tried to, you tried to do the right thing, exercise, eat the right things. And
so how long after you were diagnosed with this illness did you become blind?
Approximately 10 years.
Oh,
long time. Yes, it was. As I said, I'd been regularly going to the specialist, and they kept telling me, yes, everything looks fine, just keep on doing the same thing.
So the blindness is a result of the diabetes?
Diabetes, yes.
Well, take us up to the process of when things started to go wrong vision-wise.
Okay. I'd actually moved, or we'd moved back, this is the ex-wife and myself, had moved back to Hobart. It was in about 1992, I think we moved back to Hobart.
Okay.
Everything again was normal at that stage. At about 1999, I was driving to work one day and I noticed I was getting slightly blurred vision. And I was a little bit worried, so I went along to the eye specialist and he diagnosed that I had diabetic retinopathy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was the first indication of any eye problems for me and also for the eye specialist, to be honest with you, because I had regularly been going.
Okay. When you were getting these visual disturbances, was it all the time or did you just get episodes of blurred vision?
Up until that point, I hadn't been getting any. And afterwards, I found that I was getting them in sort of stages.
Okay.
They'd sort of go away, then come back. After I'd been to the specialist, he immediately tried some... they basically use laser treatment on the back of the retina. They basically burn a little...
To try and reattach the retina and to...
Well, what happens basically is you have abnormal growth of blood cells or blood vessels in the back of the retina, and they tend to leak and also scar. So what they try and do is seal the blood vessel by zapping it with a laser.
Okay.
So you get a little bit of scarring, but it's not as great as what you would normally get if you basically did nothing. So I went through a process, I suppose, of about 12 months of laser surgery on both eyes. And
You still had basically had sight at this time?
I had sight, but it was deteriorating.
Can just before we go on... Mm. Can I ask, how did you feel at this stage? What was your life? Was there a level of anxiety and how did it manifest?
Yeah, there was, actually. I was working at the time. I was single. I'd split with my... Well, I had divorced my wife probably about 6 years prior to that. So I was living by myself. I was a little bit worried as to, you know, how I was going to cope, cooking, the usual household-type tasks. And it even got to a stage where I was even a little bit afraid to drive a car.
Okay.
And there came a point, actually, later on where, you know, I just basically sort of put the keys of the car away and said, right, that's it, I don't want to do that anymore.
Okay.
How
did you feel inside yourself? Because I imagine this is such a huge thing to go through. Did you know that you were actually gradually going blind, or did you think it was temporary?
Initially, it didn't really dawn on me that I could actually lose total sight.
Okay.
It was only after about 6 months of treatment that I suddenly realised, oh, hello, this is pretty serious, and it looks like they're not going to be able to halt the progress of this, even though they'd promised that, you know, we can fix it. It didn't seem to be working.
Robert, how did you feel at this point? I'm assuming there would be you'd be possibly depressed or there was a degree of desperation or despair?
There was. It's probably a little hard to explain, but to my way of thinking, I thought, well, okay, this is what I've been dealt with. I either lie down and basically do nothing and, you know, fade away, or get on with it and, you know, just make the best of what's happened. And I suppose I took the latter choice. I've always been a little bit positive, I suppose, in things, so I just basically thought, well, okay, let's go on with it and see how it goes.
Can I say that particular attitude? I've heard that a lot from people in my community, gay men in particular, mm-hmm. who become diagnosed with HIV.
Right.
You know, they say, I can't do anything about it now, I have HIV, so what do you do? Do you feel sorry for yourself and go into this massive decline, or do you take the pills and get on with life? And that sounds as though that you took that attitude that you've got to get on with life, and you develop, tell me if I'm wrong, but you develop coping mechanisms, don't you?
You certainly do. For example, you learn to do things differently. I mean, obviously after a point you can't drive, for example.
That would have been probably the, for most people living the lifestyle that we do, sort of like middle class, that would have been the big one.
It was. I had actually two cars in the garage at the time, which was a bit of a pain, so I had to organise to get rid of those. And actually, the thing that really frustrated me, I just bought a brand new, very expensive TV, you know, one of those nice wide vision things.
Yeah.
And I got to the point where I was saying, well, this is pretty useless. You know, I've spent all this money on this TV and I can't see it. So I think that was actually the biggest worry I actually had, believe it or not.
You haven't missed anything. If you don't watch TV, let me tell you, it's crap. 90%
well,
of it.
Well, believe it or not, blind people do watch.
Yes.
We listen to the TV and can imagine what's actually happening.
Nadia was telling me that. She went through the process and she was sharing with our listener her experience of how she realises television. Tell us, we'll ask you a little bit about that later. I just want to go through this process of you lost your sight. Was there a turning point of, yes, I'm going to go blind?
It was probably about 6 months into the process. As I said, up until that point, and even afterwards, the eye specialists were saying, oh, yes, we can sort of halt this. They didn't offer a cure. They just said we can halt it and try and stop it at this point and not get any worse. And I sort of realised that this wasn't happening. You know, it was getting worse. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they actually zapped the back of your retina with a laser, they actually also cause a little bit of damage while they do that. So
So it's a detachment of the retina from the back of the eye.
No, it's not actually. It's just
a build-up of blood vessels.
Abnormal growth of blood vessels and the leaking of those vessels and the scarring you get on the actual retina tissue.
Oh, okay.
You can actually also, if, as you said, do sometimes get retina detachment, but that's a sort of a separate issue. And you also can get, which I did get eventually, was glaucoma, which is the pressure build-up in the eye, which again is another nasty condition which has to be treated.
Robert, when you got to this point, when you realised your sight wasn't this turning point, you still had some vision.
I did.
Can you tell us what sort of vision you had?
At that point, I was still working. I was still able to perform my job. However, reading sort of like newspapers and magazines and books, etc., was getting a little bit difficult, and I was actually having to get, because I worked in the computer industry, I had to sort of increase the font sizes and things on the computer just to be able to read the computer. There did come a point when I realised that basically I couldn't work in that area anymore, and I sort of... That was rather a big decision, and it was also a decision which I made very quickly, virtually overnight. I sort of realised one day that, this is not working, and virtually the next day I went on sick leave.
Right.
And from there on, basically into retirement.
What about the feelings you were experiencing at that time? How did you feel about all of this?
Well, very depressed, to be honest with you. I was a very active person. I enjoyed... a lot of outdoor activities, such as cycling, kayaking, surfing. And I sort of thought, well, you know, these sort of things I can no longer do, let alone, you know, how to cope with some of the more mundane type daily tasks, you know, like washing, mowing lawns, even things like making cups of coffee can get quite difficult for somebody that's actually been able to see to do those sort of things.
Because, I mean, if you're born blind, you sort of, you grow up with it. But for somebody like you, who spent most of the time doing what you do, relying on your eyesight, to have that taken away from you would be a huge challenge, wouldn't it?
It is. And I think I read somewhere or somebody told me the sight sense is about 85%. People use it that much, you know, so the rest of it... Once you lose that sense, you've actually got to develop or take more notice of the other senses. So the way to adapt is basically you use feel, you use smell, and also sound.
So have you found that you've been able to develop these other senses to a greater extent?
Yeah, well, getting back to that cup of coffee business I mentioned, like, you know, when a sighted person makes a cup of coffee, they can... first of all, find where the cup is, then find where the coffee, if you're using instant coffee, where the jar of coffee is, and if they use sugar, find that, and they can put in the right amounts and, you know, add milk and add the water. as a blind person or a sight deficient person, you can actually imagine some of the problems you have. You know, first of all, finding your cup, then finding the coffee and putting the, first of all, the right amount into the cup without spilling it everywhere, and the sugar, and then trying to add milk, you know, so it's actually at the right level, and also then trying to pour boiling water into the cup without making a mess everywhere. You know, that's a little challenging sometimes for a person that's, you know, suddenly thrown into basically sight loss.
I imagine making a cup of coffee, a lot of you'd rely on sound to hear how full the cup was.
Sound and feel, and also there is technology now which actually can help. For example, with the old-fashioned feel and sound method, you hold the cup, you can actually hear the sound of water going into the cup, and, you know, it changes pitch as it gets towards the top. And if you're brave enough, you can actually also gently put your finger across the top of the rim of the cup and slightly into the cup, so as the water comes up, you can actually feel when it gets towards your finger. And you do the same, obviously, with wine and soft drinks and anything else like that. But there are also little devices which you can actually clip into the cup, which has like a little prong which dangles down into the cup, which actually beeps when the water gets to
a
certain level.
Isn't that a good idea?
Yeah, there are certain technologies out there which do help blind and disabled people. However, they are usually very expensive for what they are. And
but because there's not a huge market for them as well.
That's the big issue, yes.
Yeah. You're listening to Adam and Peter on Allegro Non Troppo. Our special guest today is Robert Peterson. Robert is blind, but he had sight, and we're discussing the issues and things in his life. We're talking about blindness. Robert was born with sight, but some years ago he gradually became blind through diabetes. And we've been talking about the process of how this progressed and how he eventually lost his sight. And we've also been talking about just about how we felt about the whole process, because losing sight is one of the most almost unimaginable things. Robert Peterson, when you actually finally came to a point that your sight went, did you lose it completely? Do you now only see black, or do you see some?
I do have some light perception. For example, I see sort of dark and light. If there was a window, for example, in front of me, I'd see a lighter area, but things like reading newspapers and that is totally out. I just, no way.
Do you have a perception of mass? Can you tell when there's a wall in front of you or anything like that?
Yes and no. It's a funny feeling. You sort of can actually feel it in the way of how it sounds, if that makes sense.
Because your partner, Nadia, who's been on this show before, stunned me several times with the things she was saying. She said she's never walked into a car. She can always find the gap between cars and things like that because she can sense the mass.
I think it's more of a feel or the sound. For example, if you've got an open doorway, you don't get the sort of the same echo as you would if you had a solid wall in front of you. Depending, obviously, on how much sight you do have, I mean, there may be people out there which are legally blind which are able to sort of pick out doors and windows and walls and chairs and what all that sort of stuff. But for myself and Nadia, it's a case of we do have light perception, but I think it's more a case of when we notice gaps and things, it's more of a sound issue more than anything, I think.
Nadia was telling us one of the things that was quite amazing is that if people have downlights, she gets a migraine quite often, because even though she's not aware of it, she ends up staring at the downlight.
Yeah, she must hate our place. We've got a fairly new place and there's downlights everywhere in it. But she often complains, you know, that she does get, even if the windows, the blinds are open in the morning, you know, and the sun's shining, she sort of says that there is reflection or sunlight coming in and it's reflecting on her eye. How much it actually affects her, I'm not sure, but it doesn't seem to worry me as much.
And she wears sunglasses when she goes out because she doesn't want to damage her eyes with the sunlight. So that's... Now, for the listener who doesn't know Nadia, if you would like to hear, we have the podcasts that we did with Nadia. They're available on the Allegro website, allegro.org.au. Go to the podcast page, and podcasts from 2005, 6, 7, and 8 are listed in an archive there. And we have two podcasts with Nadia on. So if you look through the podcasts, and I would recommend them to people who are interested in this topic because they're quite amazing. Robert, Nadia is your partner.
Mm-hmm,
she's quite an amazing person, isn't she?
She is, actually, yes, I agree.
How did you meet her?
Bit of a long story, that.
Give us the good bits.
I could introduce some sort of Tasmanian jokes here, actually. Nadia actually is the stepsister of my brother's wife. We met in about 1988, I think it was, actually, when I still had sight, at my brother's wedding. It was just a sort of hello, how are you type meeting at my brother's wedding. I lost contact then up until, I think, in 2002 was next time I spoke to her. At that stage, I'd lost my sight. I was living in Hobart by myself. I was at a stage where I was hadn't really got much service from any of the blind organisations in Tasmania,
okay,
in regards to mobility training or anything to do with actual, you know, being able to cope. So somebody mentioned, why don't you talk to Nadia? So I got a phone number and basically rang her, and I must admit, it was one of the longest phone calls I think we've ever had. It was going on about 10 hours in length, which would have made Telstra very happy. But we just basically clicked from that point on, and over a period of about 2 or 3 months and lots of phone calls, we did finally get together, and we had a few trips backwards and forwards between Hobart and Melbourne, where Nadia was living at the time, and after about 12 months, I decided, well, sell up in Hobart and move to Melbourne. There was a lot more services offered for blind people in Melbourne. And, of course, Nadia was there, and we basically went from there.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you.
She's an amazing person, as are you, Robert Peterson. Your story is one of the inspiring things of people in our community who go through ordinary, extraordinary experiences are what makes this radio and all community radio stations so valuable in Australia. Your story is quite amazing. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your daily life now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as a blind person, you now are blind. How do you get around? How's it going?
Reasonably good. I use a white cane. As you know, Nadia has now, for the last 6 months or so, has been using a guide dog. But I work from home, so I don't have to travel normally into the city, which makes life a little bit easier for me.
What sort of work are you doing?
I'm an IT professional. I work as a consultant from home for a company which I helped create in Hobart many years ago.
So you'd use stuff like JAWS for Windows, do you?
Yes, screen reading software, all adaptive type software. In fact, actually, it's quite funny. When I lost my sight, I had two computers sitting on my desk in Hobart. Basically, I hadn't touched them for about probably 2 years. I didn't know there was anything out there which could help me. And it was only after talking to Nadia that I discovered there was adaptive technology available, and she basically got me back into it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so...
congratulations. That's fantastic. That's good. So you're an IT professional.
Yep.
You live with Nadia, but with your day-to-day business, how difficult is it for mobility and getting around?
If I'm in the house or around an area I know, there's really not that much of a problem. You tend to get to know where things are, you know, where chairs and things are, desks are, that type of thing. If it's a new area or new location, well, that could pose a problem. Using the white cane correctly obviously helps. For example, when I came here this morning, I've never been into this building, so obviously there was somebody there to meet me downstairs, which was a help. But normally I manage.
The reason I'm asking you this is I go to a gym, and it's on a very busy intersection, and this is in Carlton in Melbourne, And quite frequently, just coincidentally, when I am at the lights, there's a blind man with a cane, and he's crossing the road. I see him frequently crossing the road. And the number of times he's, and it's a long intersection, the roads are really wide, a number of times he's been halfway across the road and he starts to wander off the crossing in towards the traffic.
Right.
And I panic because I can see this man walking into the, and looks as though he's going to head into the traffic. There's huge amounts of traffic behind me and I've stopped the car and thinking, should I run out? What should I do? What should I do? But then he always ends up back on the pedestrian crossing, and a couple of times he's almost walked into the pole, but he hasn't. Mm. And he always ends up on his way again. Can you talk me through this process? What should I be doing?
Right. Well, I would say the chap's actually had mobility training, which is essential, really, to use the cane correctly. Basically, when you come, as a blind person, when you come to a light, you sort of square off at the intersection, and you, if it's a audible signal, you'll hear it beep, and then you head across. You tend to, I've actually done it myself, where you tend to wander offline, but normally you can actually hear where the cars are. So even if you do tend to walk a little bit to the left or the right of where you should be, you can actually, like this chap does obviously, you can actually pick out where you are and actually then correct yourself and then head back to where you should be going. The other thing is you would probably hear the audible signal still beeping on the other side. So halfway across he probably picks it up and says, oh yes, okay, I've got to turn slightly left or right and heads in the right direction.
Actually, Robert,
if he's been doing this a few times, you would think that even though he may look a bit sort of iffy, he's obviously got it down pretty well.
And Robert, I've just noticed something else from you saying that is also trams. There's a lot of trams, so there's a lot of background noise, so that's probably got something to do with it as well.
I'd say so. Previously, we used to live at Brunswick, and getting across between Brunswick and Sydney Road was a drama, as you can imagine. It was a pretty noisy street, and I occasionally sort of wandered away from where I should have been. But as I said, by the time you get to about halfway across, you can just pick out the beeping of the audible signal on the other side, and then you said, "Ah, oh, okay, I've got to head a little bit to the left or right or whatever it might be," and correct yourself.
It's quite, for us, having never been blind, I mean, I just can't imagine, but just listening to you talk today and the experiences with seeing this blind man, I was seriously distressed and I worried about him, and I think, you know, but the thing that I got a bit of heartening from is there were a lot of people around, and when he started to move offline, everybody stopped walking and watched him. You know what I mean? And I feel pretty sure if he'd got into any trouble, there would have been a lot of people there to help him instantly. Do you feel that?
I hope so, yes.
Have you had an experience where people have had to rush to come and help you?
Only once. It actually was a similar situation, as I mentioned, on Sydney Road there. I'd actually headed in towards... I was crossing across Brunswick Road and started heading in towards the traffic on Sydney Road. And I, for some reason, the audible signal wasn't working on the other side, so I couldn't actually pick it up. I thought I was heading across in a sort of a straight direction.
Mm.
But this lady must have been waiting on the other side to cross Sydney Road, and she saw that I was heading out in towards the middle of the traffic, and she just came across and guided me back, which I thank her for.
That's good, isn't it? I'm glad that there's that level of support.
Are people generally willing to help, do you think? Or do you think they prefer not to get involved?
I think a majority of people are willing to help. Actually, I do have a rather strange story. When I was learning my mobility training, actually, around the Brunswick area there, I had several weeks of this training, and the lady that was training me was actually this day following behind me, not actually next to me or leading me, just looking at what I was doing and making sure I was doing the right thing. And I came up to an uncontrolled street, which is no traffic signals, etc. So you sort of get to the curb and listen, and if there's no sort of traffic sound, you sort of then go across. And I got to the edge of the curb, and there must have been a chap standing there, and he said to me, "Oh, do you want to hand across?" And I said, "No, it's okay." He says, what you should do is, seems to be the best technique, is you count to 10, then go. And I thought, I don't know about that, you know. But getting back to the original question, I think the majority of people are willing to help in most situations.
See, also, one of the problems I have, and as a sighted person, this annoys me, is cyclists on the footpath. And quite often they come up behind you, you can't hear them coming.
Right.
And they whiz past you. And if you happen to deviate when they're coming past, there could be a collision. Legally, except under certain circumstances, they're not supposed to ride in the footpath, but they do.
Mm.
Have you had any problems with that?
Not really, no. I am aware of that. I'm also aware of, in a lot of areas where shops put out things on the footpath where they're not allowed to. So, you know, instead of being able to, if you're using a cane, follow the shop line, if you like, down directly through the street. You've got to sort of tangle your way through signs and tables and whatever else may be out on the footpath. But it's just being aware of your environment. You've got to be listening, basically, and sort of, you know.
Robert Peterson, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about how you feel and what's going on inside your head. How long have you been blind now?
First lost my sight in 2000, so it's going on 8 years, yes.
And you're 50, so you've had 42 years of sight and now 8 years of blindness.
That's correct.
Do you ever, I imagine if that if I was in your situation, I'd be, I don't know that I could cope, I'd find myself lying awake at night sobbing for things that I'd lost. Does that happen to you?
I don't know whether I actually get to the sobbing stage, but occasionally, yes, you do sort of grieve over the things that you've lost and can't do. Like I said earlier, I was a keen cyclist and a keen kayaker. Now, I know you can actually do those as a blind person, but you've got to have somebody else involved as well. And that tends to put me off a little bit. I'd, you know, for example, cycling, I used to just love the fact that you're able to go out there yourself and pedal away. But you do get some nights where you do lie awake and think, you know, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I could just do such and such or whatever. But I think it's a case of making the best of what you've got and adapting. I think a lot of blind people will say that they can do just about anything, which they can. There's really not much you can't do. It's just a matter of perhaps tackling it slightly differently than a sighted person.
Do you ever? Is there any ever chance you'll get your sight back, or is it gone forever now?
I won't say no. There has been recent developments with bionic eyes. I'm hoping perhaps in a few years' time, maybe that possibility is there for me, and I would jump at it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Talking to Nadia, she would probably say no. She would not jump at that.
Isn't that funny?
Well, I think, though, that's understandable, because someone who's never been able to see would have trouble, any images they might receive would have trouble interpreting them.
That's correct, yes.
Can I tell you, when I was researching today's interview, I read several stories on the internet of people who became blind, people who've been blind all their lives, and there was a story of a young woman who was blind. She had low blood pressure and she was born blind, but something happened in her life and they were able to restore, when she was about 30, her sight.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd never seen before, and she got sight, and within a few weeks she'd asked the doctors if they could take the sight away again, because she just absolutely couldn't cope with it, and she hated what was experiencing in her life. And that's amazing.
Yeah, I've actually heard a similar story, and I can sort of understand why now. You know, if you haven't had that sense and you're suddenly confronted with it, I mean, how do you handle it? How do you interpret it?
That's right, because we've had a lifetime of growing up and experiencing vision as a normal part of our lives. It's suddenly, if we suddenly had telepathy, for example, and we could read everybody's minds, we'd go mad.
We don't.
Yes, it's probably better that we don't. Robert Peterson, you dream.
Yes.
But when we had Nadia on, one of our listeners asked this extraordinary question. She never, ever has had sight, so what did she dream about? Now, you have had sight. What do you dream about, and do you find that your memories of sight are fading?
I dream like a normal sighted person still.
Okay.
I imagine images and people and things as I would in, you know, as a sighted person. I also dream in colour.
Okay.
I've actually asked blind people this same question myself, and I find I get two different answers. From somebody that hasn't had sight, they don't dream, obviously, in colour, because they don't know what colour is. It means nothing to them, other than the fact that, you know, if somebody tells them that the sky is blue and, you know, an apple is red, they associate an apple with red or redness, mm-hmm. but they don't know actually what red is.
Okay.
Or the concept of red. Whereas a sighted person usually answers, yes, they dream in images, such as you would or any other normal person would.
As time goes on, and it's been 8 years since you lost your sight, is that changing or is it exactly the same? Does your dream pattern still roundabout the same? Or because Nadia was saying she dreams in feelings and experiences. Is that happening to you, or because you've had sight, do you think that that visual imprinting is in your memory and subconscious forever? It's a real wanky question, sorry.
No, it's okay. I think actually the latter. I still dream in that image type format. I don't think that'll ever go away, to be honest with you, because to me, as I said, I can conceive as to what somebody actually looks like, whereas somebody like Nadia, for example, would their image of that person would be based on how they sound, how they might feel, as in like the shape. I don't think that's something that I will lose.
Yes. Because as I was saying to Nadia, we talk about, you know, sitting on the grass and trees, and she's never seen a tree. So the tree, while it might be relevant in that it's an organism, etc., when you say something's tree-like, that can't mean a lot to people who've never ever seen it. You, having had sight, at least have a range of experience and language that you can use in metaphorically to be able to understand and define the world. It's a remarkable story, Robert Peterson, and I'm impressed by the level of understanding, and I'm just so glad that the community seems to be helpful for you. Now, we have a lot of people listening across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Some of these people listening will be blind. Some of them will be going through the process of losing their sight or are affected by sight issues. Can you give us a few words of encouragement for these people, from your own experiences,
right,
particularly in the areas of coping?
I think you will go through a grieving process. There's no argument about that. Now, probably the easiest way of handling that is actually to get training, as in like mobility training, even simple household tasks, how to deal with those. Now, there are organisations out there which you can get that sort of training and help from. Vision Australia is one, but there are others out there. It's probably difficult for me to sort of say to you, okay, you'll be able to cope, because I probably tend to cope with things a lot easier than what most people probably do. I'm a very positive sort of person, and I sort of basically just get on and find ways of doing things. And I think that's the only way you can probably really cope, by getting in there and finding ways on, you know, as to how to be able to do what you do.
There will be counselling available, I'm sure, for people.
There is, and as I said, these organisations such as Vision Australia have mobility trainers and counsellors which will be able to help you get through that learning process, that coping process. And I think that's probably the initial step you should tackle first. You know, talk to some of these people, and they should be able to put you onto a track where you'll be able to basically help yourself.
Robert, did you ever feel like a victim? Have you ever had the why me thing?
I suppose I went through a stage, yes, you sort of ask yourself, why me? Mm-hmm. But that, for me, didn't last very long. I just sort of thought, well, okay, this is what I've been dealt with, let's get on with it.
The one thing I've been able to distill from our conversation today, as much as people think, oh, look, I can't cope with this, actually people do cope with it. They might not cope well, but eventually they cope with it. Can I just ask you, as by way of roundup, are you a religious person?
I don't belong to any sort of formal religion, but I suppose I'm spiritual, if that's the best way of describing it.
I'm just interested. If we'd had more time, I would have liked to have followed that up with you. I could sit and talk to you all day. You're one of the most interesting people I've ever interviewed. Robert Peterson, thank you for being on Allegro Non Troppo and sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much.
And perhaps sometime next year, I might like to see if I could have you and Nadia in here together.
Yeah.
And we'll have another conversation on these huge issues that affect people who are blind. This has been Allegro Non Troppo across Australia on the Community Radio Network.